is called The Buzz About Identity. The Buzz About Identity. And let me start off with the objective. Just so you know exactly what I'm aiming for in this particular class this evening. It's twofold. To identify current perspectives about the concept of identity and establish why a standard is needed to help sort through the confusion. So that's it. It's not a typical Bible study. I don't even have a Bible today, but I'm going to set it up. And then hopefully if I reach that conclusion, it will set up for the next four classes after this. So identify current perspectives. What are people talking about? Many of which you already named. And then to establish why we need a standard. That's the goal of tonight. You see an outline. I want to let you know what it is beforehand. The outline is on the first page, and it's in four parts. First, defining identity. How do we define it? What is it? So we know what we're talking about, right? Then finding identity. How do people come to know who they are? Then section three will be about debating identity. And finally, resolving identity. How can we come to a place of peace with who we are? So those are the four main sections of tonight's class that hopefully will reach our objective of explaining why there needs to be a standard. Roman numeral 1, defining identity. Now there are many ways we can do this. We could define identity through just simple textbook definitions. If you've gone to college, or you might remember in high school and you took a psychology class, you probably have some notions of what identity is. If you simply look in the Merriam-Webster dictionary, it defines identity as the distinguishing character or personality of an individual. The distinguishing character. But it does raise the question, what makes one of your characteristics the distinguishing character? How do you know? Right? And we'll get into some of that later. In the book Exploring Psychology by David Myers, he says that identity is our sense of self, which I believe was mentioned in our opening, right? It's your self-awareness. Who am I? It's answering questions. Who am I? Why am I here? According to Erik Erikson, famous psychologist from last century, he talked about when children grow up. He said the adolescent's task is to bring together the past, the present, and the future possibilities into a clearer sense of self. Adolescents wonder, and you could all relate, I'm sure, who am I as an individual? What do I want to do with my life? What values should I live by? What do I believe in? And Erikson called this the quest for identity. Answering those questions. So we can say that identity, according to the textbook and according to psychology, is a sense of self and a sense of worth. A sense of self and a sense of worth. What is my value? What is my dignity? What value do I add to my own life as well as the lives of others? But we don't get it just from ourselves and just from thinking or lying awake in bed at night. It's also coupled with the social atmosphere around us, right? People around us influence us in innumerable ways. He called social identity the we aspect of our self-concept. The part of our answer to who am I that comes from our memberships to groups. So who you are at work, or on the team, or at school, they all feed into your sense of self. In the book Created to Learn by William Yount, he says, identity produces a sense of being at home with oneself. Isn't that what people are looking for? A sense of being at home, comfortable with myself? It adds to us a feeling of stability, of knowing who one is and what one will do with life. And so fads and clothing, hairstyles, music, all of these form part of the experimentation of the stage in our adolescence when we wonder, what am I going to be when I grow up? And identity comes from reactions from significant others. How your parents react to you, or your friends, or those people that you choose to follow as role models. But what about in the modern usage now? When are country or when in the media people debate about identity, are they using identity in that sense? One professor from Stanford says that many of the dictionary definitions are outdated, and borrowing from Eric Erickson from 100 years ago is outdated. The way we use it, he says, today has changed. So he offers personal identity as some distinguishing characteristic or characteristics that a person takes a special pride in or views as socially consequential, but more or less unchangeable. Let me list several ways that we identify. What's listed on your resume? Your lineage, your ethnicity, your job history or the schools that you attended, your marital status or parental role. Perhaps you define who you are by your political leanings or the objects of your sexual longings. Maybe you consider yourself to be summed up in a Myers-Briggs category or a psychiatric diagnosis. Your sense of self might be based on money or lack thereof, or achievements or failures, or the approval of others or their rejection, or your self-esteem or your self-hatred. Perhaps you might even think that your sins define you. You see yourself as an angry man or an addict or an anxious people pleaser. Or perhaps afflictions define you. Disability, cancer, divorce. You see all the ways in which people choose to identify themselves. There are many ways then, if we borrow from modern usage and also from textbooks and psychology, many ways to define identity. But it seems that all these attempts have something in common. I want to point out three things that they have in common. One is that they're based on personal characteristics. What are some personal characteristics? Things like your appearance, right? How you look, the possessions, the things that you have, your skills, your personality, your religion, your sexuality. But also, the modern usage doesn't stop there. It also considers how those personal characteristics intersect with social categories. That means groups and group dynamics, like trends, fads, things that are popular, or politics, cultural norms and expectations, or institutional norms and expectations. I'm going to give examples of this in just a moment. And all those two things combined then offer to us a sense of worth that we attribute to how our personal characteristics interact with social categories. Now, I know that's a mouthful, so let me kind of illustrate what I mean by that. You'll see a chart in your handout. Again, here's the definition. The modern concept of identity is the sense of worth that we attribute to how our personal characteristics interact with social categories. Personal characteristics, social categories. So what are the personal characteristics? So let me give you a few examples. You see in the chart. One personal characteristic is appearance. So let's say that when you think about your appearance, you find yourself to be ugly. Maybe when you were a kid, someone called you ugly. Maybe you think that you're ugly. Many of us have struggled with this perhaps when we were in middle school, elementary school. Well, the social category, what is the trend that's out there in the world today? Do we put ugly people on posters? No, we elevate good-looking people, right? We have a picture in movies and music videos of what people should look like, and we say, you need to look like that. So how does your personal appearance of your perceived ugliness intersect with the social dynamic of good looks? Well, your sense of worth is going to be hurt, right? The third category says your appearance becomes a roadblock to social and personal value. And if you've been bullied, if you've ever been bullied in school, or you've seen people who have been bullied, you know. I knew kids, actually myself in middle school, when my nose was way too big for my face, probably still is to some degree. And that was how I was characterized. And you bet I went home many days wishing that my nose was just a little smaller. So the result of my personal appearance intersecting with the social category of good looks created an identity that was frustrated and restless. So what will happen is that person will either become super depressed and anxious, or they will do everything they can to change that one thing that's keeping them from being what they want to be. How about another example, another personal characteristic? This is a row two. In skills, skills is a personal characteristic. Suppose that you're highly proficient in basketball, and then you're really good at basketball. People are impressed with your skills, right? Well, what are the cultural expectations? In our culture today, basketball is extremely popular. You can make millions of dollars playing basketball, right? You'll get deals with Nike. You'll get on posters, commercials. I mean, this is a dream for many high school people. Basketball players trend and they generate wealth. And so your sense of worth could be wrapped up in the fact that you're so good at basketball, you have value. The value that I bring to the social dynamic is that my basketball skills can earn me money and gain me a following. And so what is the result of someone who's thinking that way? Their whole life revolves around basketball because that's where they find their sense of worth. Training, practicing, there's pride in basketball skills. Their life revolves around basketball. They're willing to sacrifice things to go to games and to train and to practice and so on and so forth. And tragically, should the person not reach the team he wants, it could completely deflate him because that's where he found his identity. One more example of how a personal characteristic intersects with a social category, the personal characteristic of possessions, things that we have. Suppose you're in middle school and you have cheap, generic sneakers. Anybody relate to that? I remember how much my big sister did not want to go to Payless because she might see her friends at Payless and that they would see that she shopped there. And I would say, but that means that they are also there. But we can relate to this, right? I mean, the institutional expectation of a middle schooler is you've got name brand sneakers and they have to cost a certain amount. Now, as adults, we've outgrown that, right? I think. But there's a time in our lives where the cool kids wear expensive name brand sneakers. And if you don't have expensive name brand sneakers and your grandma doesn't paint little swooshes on it to make it look like a Nike, you're devalued. If your identity is wrapped up in your possessions, then the type of sneaker will devalue your social standing in school. And then what will happen to a student who's thinking about his apparel, his clothing, as a sense of worth? He will be frustrated. He'll be mad, perhaps, at his parents, or upset that he's poor or not cool, and there would be an urge to change. And so you see how often identity, the way we're using it today in the modern usage, is how your personal characteristics intersect with social dynamics and the worth that you place on that. You place value because the social dynamic, whether it's your school or your job or your family, tells you this is what's worth a lot, this is what's not worth a lot, and you go along with it, and that's how many people find their identity. Well, let's look at the section two now of finding identity. What are ways that people try to discover themselves? How do they try to discover themselves? Well, here's a list of things that you see. It's also in your handout. I think many of you mentioned that in the early discussion. Our peers are very influential, right? We've been shaped by our peers, whether we like it or not. No matter how much we say, I'm an individual, I will do what I want, we have been influenced by the reactions of our peers. Those could be our friends. Those could be people that we don't like. Those could be coworkers, teammates, or neighbors. And then, of course, the culture at large has a huge influence on us through trends and politics, media, entertainment. Many people find their identity in their careers, and that can lead to workaholism. Or you're just working for the weekend, working for retirement, work, 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 and this is my identity, this is who I am. Name that job. There's also assessments out there people will go to. The Enneagram or personality test, zodiac signs to find our identity. And as someone has mentioned earlier, social media is a new thing we have to reckon with, especially among young people, as a way to find our identity. Listen to this quote. You may have seen or heard of The Social Dilemma, which was a Netflix documentary that came out, I think, last year. And the CEO of Social Capital said this. He said, "We curate our lives around this perceived sense of perfection because we get rewarded in these short-term signals, hearts, likes, thumbs up, and we conflate that with value, and we conflate it with truth. So social media is telling me who I am because of all the likes I got, all the followers I got." And people find their identity in that. The quote goes on to say, "And instead, what is fake brittle popularity that's short term and that leaves you even more, and admit it, vacant and empty before you did it." Social media is quite a force to be reckoned with in shaping the identity of so many people today. Well, how have cultures, how have individuals historically found their identity as opposed to today? And this is a very interesting section. I hope I can make sense of it best I can. There's a big difference in what's going on today. And this is one of the reasons why we have this course, is to help you understand what's happening out there in the world. You see on the left, there's a picture. You don't have to know what all those categories are, but it might remind you of maybe when you were in middle school or high school and you took a class on the feudal system or the caste system, right? And you know that for many years, many generations, many cultures around the world, you were in one of those classes. What your father did for work, you did for work. What your family produced, you produced. The sense of individualism was very, very rare. Whereas on the right side, you can find posters like this hanging up at the gym. You can do anything. You can be anything you want to be, as long as you believe in yourself and work hard. Most of human history falls on the left side. But where we are today is on the right side. Theologian Mike Bird says this: "First, identity has become unmoored from its historical harbors. Consider this. Once upon a time, who you were was defined almost exclusively by your parents, their vocation, their religion, their ethnicity, their nationality, and their village or suburb." Listen to this. He says, "Your identity was mostly inherited, geographically bound, stable, and fixed." We are far from that today, aren't we? We can do whatever we want. We can move. We can change careers. The average person has a resume filled with different jobs. But historically speaking, I'll read that again. Your identity was mostly inherited, geographically bound, stable, and fixed. Stable and fixed. But now, today, what's the difference between that and today? Today, he says, you can be whatever you want to be. We are like blank slates upon which anything can be written, or like Rorschach drawings to be interpreted in any way we wish. He says, meeting a Catholic, Gothic, vegan, libertarian is not as odd as it might have once sounded. Thus, identity comes down to the right to declare, "I am what I am, my own special creation." We are, in a sense, custom-made beings today. I think this is really well illustrated in, Tim Keller gives this a really great illustration, between two different people living in two different ages. The guy on the left is an Anglo-Saxon warrior from AD 800. The guy on the right is a young man walking around Manhattan today. I looked for the best pictures I could find of that. I looked for a Manhattanite yuppie, and this came up, and it said this is actually a new category called a yuckie, which is a young urban creative. I never heard that before. But one is living in 800, one is living in 2022. One is living in Britain and is a warrior, one is living in Manhattan and is a young urban creative person. But let's assume that within each of these men, they each have two competing very strong impulses in their hearts. One of those impulses is aggression. The other impulse is same-sex attraction. Would their culture dictate a difference in how they express themselves. The man on the left, if he sees within his heart aggression, he loves to smash and kill people when they show him disrespect, but he lives in a shame and honor culture, and it has a warrior ethic. And so he will freely identify with that feeling. He will say to himself, that's me. That's who I am. And so I will express that because I'm a warrior. That other feeling he has, same-sex attraction, well, that's not accepted in his society. So he'll say, no, that's not me. I'm going to control that impulse. I'm going to suppress that impulse because warriors don't do that. But now imagine the young man on the right. Same two impulses in his heart. The same two equally strong, difficult to control, inward longings. Aggression on one hand, same-sex attraction on the other. He will look at aggression and he will say, this is not who I want to be. Because in his society, going around smashing and killing and being a warrior is not welcome. And so he will seek deliverance in therapy and anger management. But he will look at his sexual desire and he will say, that's who I am. That's who I am. And what is the point of this illustration? It's to say this. Even in a society where we champion the individual, we do not get our identity solely from within. You cannot ignore the outside forces. In both cases, the outside culture is influencing which impulses to follow and which impulses to reject. Which impulses to follow, which impulses to reject. And so we receive from the culture an interpretive moral grid. We lay it down over our various feelings and impulses and we sift through them. And the grid helps us decide which feelings are me and we should express and which are not. So don't think that it all comes from within. Where do our Anglo-Saxon warrior and our modern Manhattan man get their grids? From their cultures, from their communities, their heroic stories. They are actually not simply choosing to be themselves. They are filtering their feelings, jettisoning some, embracing others. They are choosing to be the selves that their cultures tell them they may be. Don't discount the fact that our culture dictates what to accept, what to reject. Well, then this brings us to an interesting moment in our culture then. If that's the case, what are some of the current controversies? What are some of the things that are going on in our culture? Because our culture is saying, you can be what you want to be. You can't be a warrior, because we're past that. Well, as you know, one of the biggest controversies on identity is about transgenderism. I find it interesting that the author of this book, Abigail Schreer, who is basically, by all accounts, liberal, she supports transgender people, she's a former Wall Street Journal columnist, but now she's been canceled by some organizations. Her book was pulled from shelves. She's seen to be an advocate of pseudoscience and dangerous to transgender people, especially children. And why? Why is she such a danger? Because in this book, she raised concerns about the rise of transgenderism among young girls in her book, Irreversible Damage. And why? Because some of the statistics are alarming. And you have them, I think, on the back or on the second page of your handout. Historically, the conviction that one's gender doesn't match one's anatomical sex typically began around ages 2 to 4. And it affected only 0.01% of children, almost exclusively boys. And in 70% of cases, they eventually outgrew it. Prior to 2012, there was no scientific literature on girls age 11 to 21 ever having developed gender dysphoria. But now the picture has changed. You can see on your handout, in 2018, the UK reported a 4,400% rise over the previous decade in teenage girls seeking gender treatments. Similar spikes have been observed in many other countries. In the United States, the prevalence of adolescent gender dysphoria has increased by over 1,000 in the last decade. 1,000 in just a decade. Identity is all the rage. It's all the rage today. And what many people are saying is that you must affirm. You must affirm. So if I declare myself this race, whether or not I am, or this sex, whether or not I am, or this gender, whether or not I am, it's becoming a controversy in our society today that some people could even lose their jobs over not affirming the self-defined identity of other people. But there's confusion here, right? You can't identify as an Anglo-Saxon warrior from the 800s and do what Anglo-Saxon warriors did. You can't identify. Could I say as a Christian preacher that I believe in my new nature, the Holy Spirit of God indwells my heart and you must acknowledge me as a new creature in Christ? Because that's what I am objectively. Could I demand that on people? Could I sue them if they don't want to acknowledge that? What if they don't believe in heaven or hell or God? Should I demand that you call me born again if you don't believe in a new birth? It gets confusing as to which identities we say you have to affirm and which identities you have to reject. Carl Truman wrote in his book, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self, that this whole book that he wrote was based on this one statement, "I am a woman trapped in a man's body." He mentioned that his grandfather, who died in 1994, would never have heard such a statement. And if he did, he would consider it incoherent. And then he goes on to say, and yet today, that sentence, "I am a woman trapped in a man's body," is a sentence that many in our society regard as not only meaningful, but so significant that to deny it or question it in some way is to reveal oneself as stupid, immoral, or subject to yet another irrational phobia. So the question gets us thinking about the connection of the mind and body. What is the connection between what's in my mind and what's true about the body that I have? Imagine going to the doctor, he says, 200 years ago, and saying, "Doctor, I'm a woman trapped in a man's body." The doctor would certainly think something is wrong between your mind and your body. But that doctor would do whatever he can to help your mind get in line with your body. You fast forward today, you go to the doctor and you say, "I'm a woman trapped in a man's body." There's a good chance that the doctor would think something is wrong between your mind and your body, just like the doctor 200 years ago. But instead of trying to align your mind with your body, he might suggest doing things that would help align your body to your mind, including surgery, including chemicals. The point of all this is to say that something has changed in society. We are at a point wherein the mind, that is, how you think, how you feel, dictates the truth about who you really are. You as an individual are defined by how you express yourself, and we're at a point in society wherein those around you are shamed for not being true to your self-expression. And you see that in phrases like, "you be you," "be true to yourself." We call that expressive individualism, the definition of which is the capacity of individuals to define the terms of their own existence by defining their personal identities. In other words, those outside categories of biology, anatomy, psychology, social, that is all secondary if, at best, what I say about myself is what's true, because what I feel is what's true. And you need to affirm me in my feeling. This has led to all sorts of confusion in other examples of identities changing. You may have seen some of these things, and these are not common necessarily, but they are there. One is a thing called furries. Furries are individuals who are especially interested in anthropomorphic or cartoon animals. And they often strongly identify with those animals, and they create fursonas, which identities of themselves are those animals. Not just, I was reading one article where the guy says, it's not just dressing up in a costume. I truly become that person when I'm dressed up like a furry. We also know that there are transracial people out there. People who are born a different ethnicity, like this person in the middle, who identifies as a Filipino woman. Their race becomes different than their biological ancestry. And then there's another rare condition called body integrity identity disorder. And none of these things, of course, are meant to be mockery of what people are going through. These are real disorders that need to be addressed with love and with truth. But body integrity identity disorder occurs when your mental body image doesn't match your physical body. If you have this disorder, you might have a strong desire to amputate a limb or seek to become paralyzed, even if you're fully healthy. I thought this was interesting, though, coming from WebMD, because WebMD is a secular publication. And they say this: people with BIID want to be, and they quote, true self, which often comes with a desire for amputation or disability to help them feel complete inside. Recent research has started linking this feeling to certain psychiatric and neurological reasons. There are strong similarities between BIID and other identity disorders like transsexualism and gender identity disorder. You go to a doctor and say, "I'm a man trapped in a woman's body," they may offer you surgery to make that happen. But most of people with BIID who go to a doctor and say, "I want to amputate my arm," they wouldn't amputate the arm. So the question is, where are we drawing our standards? Yes, I agree with WebMD. There are similarities between these two things. How one feels goes against one's physical reality. But the question is, if one has gender identity disorder, why does our society promote following your true self, even to the point of mutilation and hormone-suppressing chemicals, and calling anyone who opposes those things as bigoted and narrow-minded and transphobic and dangerous, even responsible for self-harm and suicide? But if someone presents as believing in their true self that they are supposed to be an amputee, why don't doctors not affirm their chosen deep-seated feeling by going ahead with the amputation? Remember that my objective for this class today was to identify current perspectives about the concept of identity and establish why a standard is needed. And I hope you see that. Why do we need a standard? Because there's so much confusion out there. Here's what Michael Bird says. He says, as some sociologists have pointed out, it is problematic to claim on the one hand that identities are tangible, situated, and grounded in human reality. For example, black identity, womanist identity, transgender identity. But on the other hand, to regard all identities as social constructs and enmeshed in pyramids of power and privilege. And if that's confusing, it is confusing. Why do we as a society pick and choose? These are the identities that are fixed. And don't you dare try to convince someone that they're not who they say they are. But these identities, they're fluid. They can change. Well, who makes that determination? I mean, certainly there are. I think we all would agree. We change careers. We change churches. We change locations. We do change. But there are some things that are fixed. So if we agree that there are some things that are fixed and some things that are fluid, who's going to help sort these things out? This is why we need to resolve identity. This is why we need a standard. Because today's society is very, very confused. And you can see that confusion, as I'm sure you might remember a few years ago, in the case of Rachel Dolezal. Rachel Dolezal, the same person on the left and the right, one picture of her as a girl, one picture of her as an adult woman, she was the branch president of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP, and the chair of Spokane, Washington's Police Commission. She was well known and respected for her civil rights activism. One day a reporter asked her, "Are you African American?" And this article says, like a cartoon, her features froze. And she said, "I don't understand the question." The reporter pressed, "Are your parents white?" And she turned from the camera and fled. Now, if you followed the story, you know it was revealed that Ms. Dolezal was not indeed black, as she had presented herself for many years. She had lost friends, she had lost her jobs, as a result of that. And she says, and this is an interesting from a secular article, it says, if the narrative of fluid, non-binary gender identity is now accepted, Dolezal believes the same should apply to race. Now, who are you to tell this woman that she cannot identify as black? If I am required to affirm you in whatever you say you are, should we not affirm everyone in everything they say they are? She says that her belief about her race is just as real as someone else's belief about their gender. She, quote, it's very similar insofar as this is a category I'm born into, but this is how I really, you know the next word, feel. Transgender commenters have been incensed by the suggestion that there are parallels between her and transgenderism. They say transgender people transition out of medical necessity. Dolezal's transition to black, on the other hand, is surrounded by layers of deception. And again, I ask, who determines who's deceiving whom? They argue that her color was a choice, so it could not be analogous to their gender identity. But if we believe someone born without ovaries or a womb can be a woman and accept radical surgery as a legitimate corrective necessity, is it so different for a woman who was born white but feels black to reposition herself on the racial spectrum? And my question is, according to our society, we don't have an answer to that question because things are always changing. Why can't she affirm? Why did she last I heard of her, she was poor, dirt poor, because all of her positions, all of her jobs, all of her scholarships, all of her funding had been taken away. And not by people that the world would consider bigoted, narrow-minded, old-fashioned people, but people who were offended that she lied for so many years. In her mind, she didn't lie. She followed her heart, just like Disney trained all of us to do. That's the inconsistency of today's society. That's why there are many questions. I wrote them all out in the back of your handout. All these questions I ask here in our society have no consistent answer. Psychologists say one thing, sociologists say another. Biologists are divided. When does a characteristic become an identity? How do we know when to align our mind with our body or our body with our mind? When we choose an identity, to what extent must we demand others affirm it? Is it ever appropriate to refuse to identify someone by their chosen identity? Which categories are fluid? Which categories are fixed? How does our participation in a group determine who we are? How much of our identity is individual? And what scientific discipline do we follow? Sociology? Psychology? Biology? What do we do when these things contradict one another? See, again, my goal is just to show you that we need a standard. We cannot rely on the current trends because they're changing every year. What was true 10 years ago is no longer true. The scientific journals, the research professors, the psychologists, constantly changing and adapting, not just to their experiments, but also to cultural fads. What we need is a standard, a rule that can sort all of this out so that men and women can truly experience the peace of being home in their own bodies. So they would not be anxious, wondering, am I what I'm supposed to be? What can be the rule that sorts all of this out? Because it's not inside of us. We see where that leads. We are small compared to this world. We are tiny. And to find the answer within just has not worked out for us as a human race. What set of values can lead us to a more satisfying, peace-giving, consistent sense of worth and dignity? How can we truly see our value for what we truly are? Well, as we said from the very beginning, and as we promoted this course throughout the community, our goal has always been to demonstrate that the quest for identity begins with God. We human beings have created quite a mess left to our own devices. And I don't know, just turn on the news. Doesn't seem like the world's getting any better. The standard for sorting all of this confusion out must not come from within then, nor must it come from a collection of people within, but it must come from without. It must come from something that does not change. Because if those things that change have continually led us down the wrong path, we must find something that does not change. It must not come from those who would lie to us, but from someone who could only tell us the truth. And I submit to you today, there is no better place to look for guidance than to the one who created us. I mean, think about that. If he created us, and his nature transcends us, then wouldn't he alone have the right to tell us who we really are? I mean, regardless of whether you believe that's true or not about God, just follow the logic. If there is a creator, doesn't the creator have power over the creation? Doesn't the creator determine the boundaries? Doesn't the creator determine this is who you are? This is who you were meant to be. That's the goal of this course. To see how our quest for identity begins and ends in God, our Creator. So next week, that's what we will do. We will start to take a deeper look at who God is and what He reveals to us about Himself in His Word. If God as the Creator is the standard of who we are, then His Word becomes the standard and our guide. That's not to say that we can't borrow some good information from other disciplines in the world. But there's only one standard that's infallible, and that's God's Word. And so I pray and I hope that as we walk through this together, our restless hearts will find what they long for. As St. Augustine famously said 1,600 years ago, "You, Lord, have made us for yourself, and our heart is restless until it rests in you."